ever feel that pull towards, you know, the unknown, those mysteries that just keep fascinating us?
Definitely.
Well, today we're diving into one of those areas, but just a heads up, the figure we're looking at is, well, let's just say pretty controversial.
We're doing a deep dive into some really critical claims made against Chaim Vital. He's obviously a huge figure in Kabbalah.
Right.
And our main source here, the one you sent over, is an article called, it's a long Hebrew title, but basically, Amulets, Vanity, and Lies, Who Was Chaim Vital? And so on, by Shen Shalov and Nayor Tuito, published just recently, November 2024.
And it's important to say up front, this article takes a very, very critical stance, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Sharply critical. So
Preach.
our goal here isn't to, agree or disagree, but really just to unpack what the article is claiming.
Exactly. We're focusing on their core arguments that Chaim Vital allegedly did things forbidden by Jewish law. We're talking communicating with the dead, necromancy.
Sorcery, fortune telling, and that pagan beliefs might have sort of seeped into his work. That's the gist of their accusation.
Okay, so let's dig in. Where does the article start?
Well, it kicks off by saying there's this like widespread ignorance and almost a blind admiration for supposed holy Kabbalists.
Okay.
And they single out two main figures, Rabbi Isaac Luria, the Ari,
The RA, yeah.
and his main student, Chaim Vital. The authors are pretty blunt. They say their aim is to prove that Vital, following the Ari, just ignored major biblical prohibitions and did things they find, well, reprehensible.
Okay, so the first big one they tackle is this prohibition against seeking out the dead.
Right. They quote Deuteronomy 18, verses 9 to 13. It's that passage warning against adopting the customs of other nations.
The one that lists divination, sorcery.
And specifically consulting the dead,
Yeah.
yes. The article really hammers this point. They say it's incredibly serious to even learn these things, planning to do them.
And especially to teach them to others.
Exactly. They see that as a major, major problem. And to back this up, they bring in Maimonides, the Rambam.
Of course. So they cite his rulings. Where from?
Sefer HaMitzvot, Negative Commandment 38, and also Mishneh Torah, Laws of Idolatry, Chapter 11, verse 13.
And what does Maimonides say there that the article finds so relevant to Vital? What's the connection they're making?
Well, Maimonides flat out forbids seeking knowledge from the dead. The article highlights his examples like fasting to get answers in a dream from someone deceased, or doing specific rituals, to try and make contact. The key thing, according to the article's reading of Maimonides, is any deliberate action to get information for the dead is forbidden.
Okay, this is where it gets specific to Vital then. The article points directly to his own writings.
Yes, exactly. They quote from his Sha'ar HaYichudim, The Gate of Unification, chapter 4, verse 4, apparently.
And what does Vital describe there?
He describes how someone should prostrate themselves on a grave, like lie down on it.
On the grave itself.
Yeah. And he says that by doing this, intending to connect with the soul of the person buried there, you can receive answers and wisdom.
Wow. Okay, so the article sees this as.
As a smoking gun, basically. They argue this is a clear, direct violation of the Torah's ban on consulting the dead. Full stop.
And not just that he did it, but that he taught it.
That's the other part of their argument. By writing it down, teaching this practice, they say he created a really harmful precedent, leading people down a forbidden path. So for them, it's not just curiosity, it's actively teaching prohibited acts.
The article seems to suggest the issue isn't just about getting forbidden information, though.
No, they go further. They argue the very act of trying to talk to the dead is inherently risky.
Why? What's the danger?
Because it can lead people towards, false beliefs, even towards paganism itself. They see it as a slippery slope.
Okay.
They analyze the Hebrew phrase, Doresh El Hametim, seeking out the dead. Their take is that it means turning away from seeking understanding from God.
Then turning towards the dead instead.
Precisely. A fundamental shift in focus. And they connect this to the whole idea of Merkava, the work of the chariot, that deep mystical exploration of God's ways.
Right, the highest levels of mystical understanding.
The article suggests Vital's methods are like a forbidden shortcut, trying to get that kind of knowledge through the wrong channels, bypassing the proper ways.
And they also bring in that warning from the Mishnah, don't they? About not delving too deep after Rabbi Akiva's time.
Yes, Mishnah Haggadah. The warning against exploring what's beyond human grasp. The article basically argues, look, if even Rabbi Akiva's students were cautioned, then Vital, by claiming this access through the dead, was definitely crossing established boundaries. He was overstepping.
So accusation number one, necromancy. But the article doesn't stop there. They bring up another prohibition related to the grave prostration.
That's right. The even meskit, the adorned stone prohibition from Leviticus 26.1.
How does that connect?
They argue that Vedel's instruction to lie fully prostrate on a grave also violates this law. They cite Maimonides again, Sefer HaMitzvot, and Mishneh Torah.
And Maimonides' reasoning there was?
It was to stop Jews from copying idol worshippers who used to lie down flat on decorated stones in front of their idols. It was about avoiding even the appearance of idolatry.
Even if you were doing it for God.
Especially then, according to the article citation of Maimonides. The specific posture, fully stretched out on the stone, was the problem, because it looked too much like pagan practice. And the article draws a direct line from that to Vital telling people to lie on graves.
This is pretty heavy stuff, but the article claims there's more direct evidence, right? This manuscript.
Ah, yes. This is a key piece for them. They talk about the discovery of a manuscript by Vital himself called Sefer HaPalo, Book of Actions, or sometimes Sefer Talmud Chochma, Book of Hidden Wisdom.
Okay.
Researcher Yuval Harari apparently brought this more into the light. The article presents it as like Exhibit A.
And what's in this Book of Actions that's so crucial for their argument?
Well, according to the article, it's basically a manual for magic, practical Kabbalah, medicine, alchemy, the works. But critically, it apparently contains 19 specific actions or recipes just for communicating with the dead, mostly through dreams.
19? That does sound like quite an emphasis.
That's what the article suggests. They imply that compared to other similar texts, this focus is significant.
Can you give us some examples? What kind of things does Vital allegedly instruct people to do?
Sure. One example they cite involves using leftover candle wicks from Shabbat.
Okay.
You're supposed to state your intention while lighting them that you want to see a particular person, living or dead, in a dream. Then after Shabbat, you put the leftover wicks under your pillow.
To make them appear in your dream.
That's the idea, yeah. The article sees this as a clear attempt to manipulate dreams to contact the deceased.
Okay, what else? Some sound quite intense.
There's a really disturbing one they mention. It involves getting crow eggs, boiling them, putting them back in the nest so the mother crow brings a specific stone.
A stone.
Yeah, a hard stone. Then you supposedly take that stone and place it on the mouth of a corpse.
On the corpse's mouth.
Yes. And the idea is that the corpse will then speak and answer questions.
Wow. That's pretty graphic. The article must see this as undeniable necromancy.
Absolutely. They present it as just blatant textbook necromancy.
Mm-hmm.
And they say these writings are clear proof Vital was deep into seeking out the dead and following, you know, false beliefs.
Are there other examples from this Sefer HaPalo?
Oh, yeah, they list several more. One involves going to a grave, picturing the person asleep, calling their name, saying why you're there,
mm-hmm.
then taking some soil from the grave and using it somehow to compel the spirit to answer you in a dream. So again, it's presented as active engagement, not just remembrance.
A direct interaction with the spirit.
Another one uses coriander seeds. You write specific names on the grave's earth with the seeds, wait 7 days, and then the deceased is supposed to show up in your dream with the answer.
The level of detail is striking.
It is. And the article highlights that. They mention another ritual calling on the deceased by name, invoking angels linked to the dead, putting grave soil under the pillow again, all aimed at getting truthful dream answers.
It seems this book provides a lot of fuel for their fire.
Definitely. There's even one for when someone is dying. You perform a ritual, invoke angels, promise charity for the soul, all to make sure the person appears after death to answer questions truthfully. The article's point is, look at the pattern. Vital was actively teaching multiple methods for contacting the dead.
Okay, so necromancy is a huge part of the critique.
Yeah.
But they also accuse him of divination, right? Cosmeme.
Correct. Yeah. Fortune-telling. They explain this is also forbidden. And again, they lean on Maimonides, citing Sefer HaMitzvot, Negative Commandment 31.
What's Maimonides' definition of cosmeme here?
He describes it as using various actions like tapping a stick, throwing stones, staring at something. Not because the actions do anything magical, but because they stimulate your own power of conjecture, your intuition, maybe.
So it's not about real magic, but about triggering guesses about the future.
That's the article's interpretation of Maimonides, yes. They say practices like palm reading, card reading, even reading oil drops. Maimonides saw them as just techniques to activate that guesswork.
Yeah.
And doing any of those things, according to the Maimonides citation, makes you a kosem, a diviner. They quote the verse from Deuteronomy, "There shall not be found among you a diviner."
So how do they link Vital to this? Did he practice divination himself?
They point to his other book, Sifr Hechizianot, the Book of Visions. They give an example where Vital writes about visiting someone in Seyfed who claimed they could reveal the future by summoning spirits, living or dead. The article implies that even associating with such a person, seeking them out, is problematic. It validates the practice.
So engaging with fortune tellers.
And more directly, they cite other passages from the same book. Vital apparently describes consulting women who read oil drops, a practice its article lumps in with fortune telling.
Reading oil drops?
Yeah. And another person called the Dream Master. Vital supposedly asked this person about the future using oil. So the article argues, these show Vital himself engaging in practices aimed at predicting the future forbidden divination.
Okay, necromancy, divination, what's the third main charge? Sorcery, Mekusef.
Yes, Mekusef. And surprise, surprise, they quote Maimonides again. Sefer HaMitzvot, Negative Commandment 34, and Laws of Idolatry, Chapter 11.
And the issue with sorcery, according to Maimonides here, is...
that is a serious crime, maybe even punishable by stoning. Why? Because it creates the illusion of power separate from God. It props up idolatrous thinking.
So it's about misleading people into believing in magic, not necessarily whether the magic worked.
Exactly. The danger is promoting false beliefs in non-divine powers. The article then gives examples again from Sefer Hechizianot.
Like what?
Well, one tells of a woman in Jerusalem and Damascus who claims she saw a pillar of fire over Vital's head while he was preaching.
The pillar of fire.
Yeah, and Elijah the prophet at his side. And the text notes, this woman was known for having accurate visions of spirits and angels. The article seems to use this to show Vital was associated with supernatural claims in people's eyes.
Suggesting he was seen as having or being around some kind of power.
That seems to be the implication. Mm. They also mentioned Rabbi Yosef Segura visiting a Muslim sorcerer who did sand divination and saw spirits. And that Vital himself later talked to this sorcerer about Kabbalah.
Mm.
And another one about a Rabbi Waibum who supposedly brought down an angel using a mirror, a magical practice, and Vital questioned the angel. Again, it shows Vital engaging with these sorts of practitioners and practices.
So the article is painting a picture of someone deeply involved in the magical milieu of the time.
Pretty much. And they cap off this section by quoting Maimonides' very strong rejection of all magic as basically falsehoods that tricked ancient idolaters.
Right.
Maimonides says, you know, intelligent Jews shouldn't fall for this stuff, emphasizing simple faith. Tamin kihe im Hashem Elokecha. Be wholehearted with the Lord your God. The article clearly sets up Vital's alleged actions as the polar opposite of this Maimonidean ideal.
Okay, the next part of the article seems to shift gears into territory that's, well, even more disturbing, allegations of immoral, maybe dangerous practices.
Yes, this is where they present some really quite shocking material. They bring in research by Tomer Persico, specifically his review of a book by Ronit Weinstein called Break the Vessels.
And then what's the connection there?
Persico's review, as cited, draws parallels between Kabbalah in 16th century safed and, interestingly, Catholic counter-reformation practices happening around the same time.
Catholic practices? Like what?
Things like venerating saints, a big focus on the afterlife, praying to angels, messianic excitement, focus on consciousness, original sin, martyrdom. Also the rise of female religious figures, stricter rules, and a real preoccupation with the graves of holy people. The article uses this comparison to hint that maybe some safed Kabbalistic trends weren't entirely, you know, homegrown Jewish developments.
That's a provocative idea. How does it tie into the specific practices they accuse Vital and the Ari of?
Well, the article highlights Weinstein's argument that for the Ari and his circle, the human body became this central stage for religious drama. It wasn't just about manipulating stars or heavens anymore. The focus shifted, maybe uncomfortably, onto the physical body.
Okay.
And this, the article suggests, leads into what they call sexual mysticism in Lurianic Kabbalah, where divine stuff gets explained using very physical sexual metaphors.
Which sets the stage for these really shocking examples the article pulls out.
Exactly. Allegedly from Vital's and the Ari's writings, the first one they cite from Vital's Sefer Hapalo, involves taking the foreskin from a baby's circumcision,
okay,
the father's foreskin, and putting it in the newborn baby's mouth. Supposedly, to ward off ambrosia, they identified this as Lilith, who is thought to harm infants. The article just calls this repulsive.
I can see why. What else?
Another one from Sefer Hapalo. Using semen from a boy who has never emitted semen before,
right,
to anoint the lips of someone having an epileptic seizure as a cure. Again, the article condemns this as perverse.
And then there's a third one attributed to the Ari himself.
Yes, from a text called Toli.Haari. It describes a woman having a really difficult childbirth. The Ari supposedly said the only way to save her was if a man who had never emitted semen placed his brit, his circumcised organ,
in her mouth.
In her mouth, yes. And the text apparently says Rabbi Moses Galanti did this.
That's incredibly shocking.
The article uses words like disgusting, abhorrent. They then quote Persico, asking essentially, how can you believe in the deep mystical teachings of these figures if you also look at this kind of frankly bizarre and disturbing magical advice, or vice versa? It questions their credibility overall.
The article then goes back to Sefer Hapalo for more examples of what they call abominations.
Yes, more magical practices. One involves invoking an angel named Tistiel, who apparently rides a lion and has a copper staff. There are instructions on how to command it.
Like a spell.
Pretty much. Another is a formula with special names written down and put under a doorstep to bring peace between a husband and wife. The article stresses these aren't metaphors. They're presented as actual magic rituals.
And the article's point is that these are fundamentally different from, say, legitimate folk remedies or spiritual practices.
Exactly. They argue this is Vidal engaging directly in magic, and that this influenced later amulet makers and superstition, which they claim comes straight from paganism. Make a really strong claim that Lurianic Kabbalah itself is built on Sabaean and other ancient pagan foundations.
That's a huge claim. What other examples do they use to support it? More from the book.
Yes, more unusual advice, like smearing a young girl's breasts with pig's milk before puberty to stop them growing. The article calls this pagan magic and borderline deviancy.
Good.
They repeat the example of using a boy's semen for epilepsy, calling it traumatic, magical, inappropriate.
And they bring up the foreskin example again?
They do. They explicitly label it potential child abuse and pedophilia, especially noting Vidal apparently wrote about doing this himself with young boys. They even mention modern prison sentences for such acts to underscore how serious they consider it.
They also mention remedies using animal parts.
Yeah, like bear fat for wisdom, hoopoe egg and tongue for success, rabbit or dog heart against witchcraft. The article says this shows Vidal believed in witchcraft and pagan superstitions, which goes against basic Jewish reliance on God. They quote Maimonides, again believing this stuff is just foolishness.
So a pattern of superstitious and, in some cases, deeply disturbing practices linked to paganism.
That's the picture they paint. They list more odd remedies, linking them to Sabaean idolatry, repeat the seven epilepsy one again, and then they circle back to necromancy.
How so?
There's an instruction on getting a speaking stone from a crow's nest to talk to the dead. They immediately cite Deuteronomy and Maimonides against necromancy again.
And one more involving a crow.
A really nasty one. Killing a baby crow, waiting for the parent to bring a special stone, and using that stone to become invisible. The article condemns it as animal cruelty, points out it's illegal under Israeli law today, even mentions fines or jail time. They're really pulling no punches.
Wow. Okay, so the final section takes a bit of a surprising turn. They bring in Rabbi Nachman of Breslov criticizing Maimonides. How does that fit in?
It seems a bit out of left field at first, but they're building to a point. They quote Rabbi Nachman from Chaya Moharan, where he really goes after studying philosophy mixed with Torah.
He wasn't a fan of Greek philosophy influencing Jewish thought, right?
Not at all. He condemns Ibn Ezra, Ralbag, anyone influenced by Aristotle, calls them heretics, basically. Says even mentioning Aristotle makes you an Epicurean corrupting people. He was very strong on this.
Okay, so Rabbi Nachman, philosophy bad.
Right. But then the article offers a counterpoint about Maimonides. They say, look, Maimonides only used bits of Greek philosophy that didn't clash with Jewish monotheism or Torah law. He recognized wisdom elsewhere.
And Maimonides criticized Aristotle when he disagreed, like on resurrection.
Exactly. Attributed it to Aristotle lacking faith in miracles. So the article sets up this contrast.
And where does Vidal fit into this Rabbi Nachman versus Maimonides discussion?
Here's the twist. Rabbi Nachman, who hated outside philosophy, strongly advocated studying the Zohar and the writings of the Ari.
Ah, and who spread the Ari's teachings.
Chaim Vital. And who did Vital learn from or cite? This is the article's punchline. They pull out examples from Vital's Sefer Hapalot again.
Showing what?
Showing Vital explicitly citing pagan authorities like Plato and Galen for his magical remedies and beliefs.
He actually names them Plato, Galen.
According to the article, yes. For things like using peony root for epilepsy, citing Plato, or drinking water via a wolf's rectum for a sore throat, citing Galen. Also Red Threads for snake bites, Alum for fear, Bat Heads for baldness. Vital apparently credits these non-Jewish pagan sources.
So Vital himself is openly drawing on the very kinds of outside non-Jewish sources that Rabbi Nachman seemed to detest.
That's exactly the dilemma the article poses. They ask, if Rabbi Nachman condemned Maimonides for carefully using some Greek philosophy that fit with Torah, how can his followers possibly justify studying Vital, who seems to have just wholesale adopted pagan magic and superstition that Maimonides himself rejected?
It's a sharp conclusion.
Very sharp. They basically say, by Rabbi Nachman's own logic, shouldn't the works of the Ardian Vital also be forbidden?
Well, this deep dive has definitely uncovered some incredibly serious and frankly quite shocking allegations against Chaim Vital as laid out in this specific article.
It really has. We've walked through a very critical perspective on a major figure in Kabbalah based entirely on the source you provided. The article paints Vital as someone who, they claim, broke fundamental Jewish laws and heavily rely on pagan magic and superstition.
It certainly gives you a lot to think about regarding, you know, the origins and nature of some Kabbalistic practices and how they developed.
Absolutely. And it goes without saying, this is just one perspective based on one article and the sources it cites. A full picture would need way more research looking at Vital's work directly, considering other historical views, the ongoing scholarly debates. It's complex.
Definitely. But based just on the claims we've unpacked today from this source, it raises a big question, doesn't it? What does it really mean to critically engage with historical religious figures and texts? And maybe even more pointedly, how do you reconcile such deeply conflicting perspectives when you find them within a tradition?
That is indeed a profound question to mull over.